Support for Father David Abernethy and his ministry at the Pittsburgh Oratory of St. Philip Neri comes entirely from the donations of community members and listeners like you. The creation of future groups and podcast episodes depends on your commitment and generosity. We humbly ask that you consider a monthly gift of $10 to the Pittsburgh Oratory in support of Father David and his work. To make this or any gift, please visit www.thepittsburghoratory.org, click the Donate button, and write Father David in the notes section. You can also make a recurring or one-time donation directly through Podbean. Your commitment and ministry-sustaining support are greatly appreciated. God bless you, and enjoy the podcast.
Help us in the name of the Lord, who made heaven and earth. Okay. Tonight, we're starting a new hypothesis, number 13. And the various authors will be speaking about the importance of living in a remote place, which certainly makes sense for desert fathers, you know, emphasizing the importance of solitude and what constitutes a remote place, which is sort of interesting because then this brings us into our world, because they're not simply speaking of a physical place, that it also has to do with the reality of what's going on within the heart and the benefits, the particular benefits of fostering solitude in one's life. And this is where I think we're going to be able to draw a lot out of this hypothesis, even though it seems clearly directed towards those who are living in radical solitude. It's not only monks who need to foster solitude in their spiritual life, but it's all Christians, I think, as we are seeking to develop a deep prayer life and to foster a kind of stillness of heart in order that we might be able to listen to God. It's important for us to be able to set aside lengthy periods of time where there are no distractions. And I think people in our day are very familiar with sitting in silence, but they're sitting with electronic gadgets. And this is not the same thing as solitude. That's more like isolation and distraction. And typically it breeds a kind of agitation of heart rather than stillness. And or as simply a kind of loneliness, whereas the solitude of the Christian is to open up the opportunity for intimacy. And even in marriages, Henry Nouwen writes a little bit about this too, that solitude is something that is necessary for intimacy to emerge, that it becomes necessary for those who are in the most intimate relationship to be able to draw back, to enter into prayer, to have periods of deep silence, in order that they might reapproach each other with this clarity about their vocation and how they desire to enter into this relationship with each other. And so certainly what we'll be reading here tonight, even though it seems to be directed towards monks, it is directed towards us as well, without a doubt. And so very important for us. And so tonight we're starting from little sections from the Gerontocon, sayings of the fathers, Athenite fathers. And number one, Abba Iakovos said that it is of even greater worth for one to become a stranger himself for the sake of God than to show hospitality to strangers. And so for one who is embracing the life of radical solitude, who's committed himself to seek God in silence and stillness, this makes sense, that one would come to prize and hold precious the cell and the solitude that offers in order that one might engage in an unceasing prayer. And what becomes a distraction then is whatever leads a person out of that cell to enter into conversation with others, to break that commitment to seek God in unceasing prayer. Why enter into the desert if you're not going to stay immersed in the solitude and seek the deepest stillness of one's heart? And so, you know, the monks that are often described in some of these stories are those who, you know, whenever they hear other monks running or walking by, they run out to the door to see who's passing by, or they make a habit of visiting the cells of others to have conversations. And so the desert monks weren't immune to their own kind of distraction, of being pulled away from this deep silence that allows us to have this intimacy with God, but also to be able to listen to God on a very deep level, to hear his word as he speaks to us in that silence. And so what he says here is important: to become a stranger oneself for the sake of God. That we'll hear this again in St. John Climacus's Ladder of Divine Ascent that we're turning to after St. Theophan's writing. He has a whole step dedicated to exile, of leaving one's country and leaving what is familiar, and even doing it without a sense of security, that there is a kind of radical act of faith in doing so, that we leave what is comfortable to us or offers us a worldly security or peace, and we set off in response very much to what Jesus says in the gospel. If you would be holy, go sell all that you possess, come follow me, and then come follow me. And so the desert monks ought to do this in a radical way, even going to a different country, and in order that they wouldn't cling to anything of this world, that they would attain even a greater freedom interiorly, that setting aside one's material goods didn't necessarily address what goes on interiorly. And so letting go of even earthly relationships was to embrace a kind of poverty that certainly is difficult and not that everyone is called to, but to let go of the familiarity that we have with others and the support that they might give us in our day-to-day life, and to rely upon God and his grace and what he provides through providence, and to do this in a radical way. And so again, this, you know, for our sensibility, some of what we read here tonight may seem jarring to us, but I think we need to, again, slow ourselves down and think, why are they communicating this as being something important? What did it hold out in terms of a promise to the monk to embrace this kind of worldly exile and to seek out as something to be valued, this kind of deep solitude and distance from other human beings? When by nature, you know, we are social, you know, that we seek out the company of others. Number two, Abba Longinos once asked Father Lukios, "Abba, my soul yearns to dwell in a remote place." He responds, "If you do not succeed in controlling your tongue," the elder replied, "you are not in a remote place, no matter where you move. But if you control your tongue, then you will be far removed even here." So here's where things begin to become a bit refined, that one can live in the desert and yet not have control of one's tongue and constantly be chattering, either in one's head or to the closest person that they can find. That the ability to control one's tongue allows for a kind of silence to emerge wherever one lives. And so one can experience this kind of solitude within the family or one's home by retreating to a quiet place and there to engage in prayer. And I think last time, in one of the groups, I mentioned Philip Neri's vision of the nido, the nest, that after one had finished one's work, one's ministry, one would gravitate as quickly as one could back to the nido, to the nest, the place of prayer, of contemplation. And so solitude is tied then to this inner stillness that one is fostering. Again, it's not solitude for solitude's sake. It's not becoming a hermit because you hate people. It's entering into a deep solitude in order that you might first silence the external realities and then gradually begin to experience an external stillness as well. And so controlling the tongue becomes very important, that you not only remove yourself from the company of others, but still your own thoughts, which can crowd in upon you as much as other individuals. And if you're fostering this through a constant chattering, you know, either with others or within, the solitude, the external solitude, is not going to bear the fruit that is desired. And so actually a person living in a city and who is following this counsel and fosters these periods of silence within their life, who retreat daily in order to engage in prayer, can actually attain a greater level of stillness of someone than someone living in a monastery. And, you know, I did visit the monasteries in Egypt once, and I visited Trappist monasteries too on occasion. And sometimes you go there and you find chatterboxes. You know, you are going there for retreat because you want this silence. You know, you're getting away from things, and you'll find a monk there who's desperate to talk to someone new. And so you get locked in these conversations with individuals. And so it sort of tells you something important, though, that there is a kind of spiritual battle and a clarity that one has to have in terms of how these things are connected to each other. And why we are fostering them, and that there is a discipline, even when one has the external realities in place, to allow to arise. Because if not, like particular monks who are chatterboxes, they might destroy that stillness for a weekend for an individual, as well as for themselves. And you know, I came across a book when I was at one of these monasteries of hand signals that Trappist monks would use. They had their own kind of sign language in order to sort of communicate with each other, you know, about things that were needed throughout the course of the day, so they could maintain certainly the grand silence, but the typical silence throughout the course of the day. But one could imagine one could still be a chatterbox with one's hands in an annoying fashion. But nonetheless, this is an important counsel, the control of the tongue. And this is true for all of us, you know, that we watch our speech. Hold on for 1 second. We control our speech in order to then still our hearts. That is controlling the externals first. We move from the outside in. And so we create the environment that allows for a stillness to begin to emerge within our hearts. Because the greatest struggle with us, for us, as we've said, is with our own thoughts, the multiplicity, the thousands of thoughts daily. And so we enter into an external silence and stillness in order to help us then foster that internal silence through the practice of something like the Jesus Prayer, where we move from that multiplicity to the simplicity. And this is why within our churches, you know, even Philip Neri said, we should never make any noise in church whatsoever, except in the gravest necessity. And I know that that's out of fashion and people are going to rip me on this. But I think, you know, Philip was this incredibly joyful character, but he knew the importance and the value of solitude. You know, he spent the first 10 years of his life immersed in the catacombs of Rome all night in prayer, to imitate the desert monks. And so he knew that in our worship, that silence was to be fostered, that the church was not to be a kind of social event. You might have the social event afterwards in the church hall, but the church itself was to be a place where one is to be intensely focused upon God. And one of the great acts of love and acts of faith that we can make in that moment is to still our heart and give our complete attention over to him. And so even someone like Philip Neri was, you know, very strict in this regard. And it's interesting, you know, it took us a long time here at the Oratory, and it was only with the aid of Eucharistic adoration that the chapel really became this kind of place of prayer, because we struggled with the same thing that I think you often see take place in churches. As soon as before Mass starts, everybody's sitting there having a conversation with each other, even if the person next to them is trying to pray and prepare themselves. And then immediately after the closing prayer or the final hymn, then the church burst out into conversation. And so making an act of thanksgiving becomes almost an impossibility in many places. And with adoration here, it was sort of interesting, because when we would have the adoration right up to the beginning of the Mass before we would repose for the Mass. And so as people would come into the church, they would make the double knee genuflection, and they would go into their pew and they would pray silently. So over the course of time, it fostered this habit of silence. And similarly, it was sort of interesting, you know, the habit was often after Mass, people would file out immediately to shake the hand of the priest. And I never liked that anyways, because you're trying to say goodbye to like 300 people at the same time, which is impossible. And if one person wants to have a conversation during that period, then forget it. You've like missed half the congregation because one person pulls you aside. But I digress. When we started adoration, then all of a sudden, especially with daily Masses, you'd go out of the chapel and then maybe a couple people who had to go off to work or something would leave, but everybody else stayed within the chapel. And when you go back in to, you know, clean up the sanctuary and to bring the chalice back into the sacristy, everybody was kneeling, making their act of thanksgiving. And so gradually things began to change. Those who were most troublesome were the older generation, to be quite honest with you. And not because there was anything wrong with them, but I think they were brought up with this sense of this is how it was done for so many, you know, for a generation or so, that this was the practice. And so it took a long time, I think, to foster this kind of expectation that this was a house of prayer. And one would maintain that silence as much as one could in and around the chapel in order that those who are engaged in prayer might be able to do so freely. I'm not sure who put their hand up first. Was it Tyler or Mark? Tyler. Okay, Tyler.
I think you made a good point there, especially with adoration, just trying to create that sacred silence, because I find that even like one of the strangest kind of things that happened this kind of pandemic is like we were kind of going for communion during Divine Liturgy. We are used to having more people on hand assisting the priest. Like some churches, you have more deacons or whatnot, because there's just one priest now dispensing communion to everyone reverently. Then the problem happens where it's like the choir goes into this, well, we've only prepped for like say three or so songs. It's like we need to extend it longer, but I think that's an opportunity right there. It's like even during the communion line, is give people an opportunity to experience that sacred silence. Another time, I honestly have a hard time experiencing silence myself in life, but no greater experience of silence is during Great Friday and Holy Saturday, standing vigil at the tomb and just praying before the holy shroud. And that creates the perfect sense of silence, like whether it's adoration or right there in front of the tomb. It's wonderful. It's actually helps you center and build a strong spiritual foundation, because there's too much noise in this world.
That's right. And we don't want to add to it. And I think the one place where we can preserve it is within church. And I think that's what's often frustrating at times. It's the one place where you can have it. And we bring the noise of the world in with us. And, you know, I think it's important for us to understand that this is a kind of asceticism, like anything else that we've talked about, fostering this solitude and the silence that it gives birth to over the course of time, and that we might feel great dis-ease with the silence. And if we go on retreat, we might feel dis-ease with the solitude of that. And I've mentioned, you know, we just talked about adoration here. And in the early years with the students, the first semester of adoration, you'd see they'd bring books in and all kinds of stuff because to focus their attention on, because the silence was so intense that it could feel very difficult and almost painful for them. You could see it, you know, the struggle of what to do and looking around and until about 3 or 4 months, and then you begin to see things slow down a little bit and not bringing in an armful of books, and then beginning to long for that period during the week that they had set aside. And so it's an ascetical discipline that we really at times have to work to foster and want to have extended periods of solitude and silence in order that then our daily prayer life might become imbued with this desire for the kind of stillness and silence where we can have this intimacy with God, that we're able to step into that with greater ease and facility because we're living in a more recollected kind of state. And eventually you find yourself, you know, turning off the TV and not turning on the car radio when you get into the car, because you begin to realize that there are all these opportunities throughout the course of the day to regain something of that stillness that is often lost by the noise that surrounds us. Mark.
The silence bit is very interesting. It is something we've lost in the West. Some people today think it's one of the good things of Protestantism to be friendly. But historically, when you came into a Protestant church, you didn't talk in the sanctuary. Mm-hmm. Someone would come up to you and say something. You can read about this in the early 1900s and 1800s. I've been to Sabbath Day Lake, Maine, where the Shakers still have a place, and read some of their books. Ken Burns did a very good short documentary on them. And the Shakers were known for somewhere in their service sort of having a dance where they did a shake. Mm-hmm. They were not ecstatics. They did not roll on the floor. And it was the rule that you shall come into this house of prayer in silence. And there was absolutely no images. It was very plain, but the house of prayer was the house of prayer. And there was never like this idle chat.
Right.
And just a quick plug for some, if you will, friends of mine. They don't advertise much, but I've made several retreats in Livingston Manor, New York, in the Catskills with the monastic family of Bethlehem. They're Carthusian-like. Mm-hmm. If you go there, they kindly ask you to swear in writing that you will not engage or chit-chat with anyone.
My kind of place.
I love it. By the way, you get your own little cabin. Mm-hmm. The upstairs is only for worship. Mm-hmm. It is a beautiful place, and I encourage some people to do it.
Right. Yeah, that's all magnificent. And, you know, I think there was something even about culture in the past, you know, that fostered a kind of slowed things down, that, you know, we didn't have a constant, this flow of noise and activity and the kinds of activity that sort of agitate. I mean, even in play as kids often involved more silence. You know, I remember playing in a creek, turning over rocks, trying to find, what were they called, crawdads, you know, and things like that, or just, you know, playing in the woods. And even with friends, you know, playing army and stuff like that, you'd be out all day long. And it seemed to be more stillness. Or uncles taking you fishing, where you would be on a stream for a number of hours. And like fishermen don't talk to each other while they're on the stream, they're fishing. And so if you grow up in a family where there was sort of this outdoors kind of sense of things. And we had an uncle who was a game commissioner. And so we are often exposed to that kind of stuff, you know, fishing and some of the cousins hunting. And one uncle taught art. You know, he was a great oil painter and pastels. And so he'd teach a lot of the nieces and nephews how to paint or to draw. And again, those are kinds of activities that are contemplative by nature. And so it seems like we've lost a good bit of that, because I think a person can sit in the house all day, again, alone. But that could be more isolation, and they might even be communicating with others, but still, you know, alone in one's home, there's not a real kind of tangible intimacy that are being achieved. Eric Chastain.
Yeah, so actually, there are a lot of things that you said that brought up things for me. I think probably I'll keep it brief, I promise. But the people talking at church, or not giving the ability for people to pray after Mass, it's a really terrible thing. I noticed it when I was young, and I actually felt very bad about, well, I don't know if it was that I was trying to do Thanksgiving after Mass per se, but definitely during communion, there was absolutely no time for doing any prayer. Mm-hmm. And I do notice that people talk sometimes even throughout the Mass. Mm-hmm. Now, I do know that, you know, our standards right now for this stuff are very, very different than what things were like in the Middle Ages, because I've seen reenactments and people just talk and talk and talk and talk, because it was a different kind of setting. But in any case, yeah, I do feel like after Mass, there's absolutely no time. In most parishes, there's no time to pray and Thanksgiving. You know, people are tripling over themselves trying to get out. You know, it's truly a sight to see. The exception, of course, that I've found is just that there are these places and there are these pockets in the traditional Latin Mass parishes that I go to, where they are at the opposite extreme. They intentionally form a zone of silence, and you will find that in most of these communities. And outside of those communities, honestly, you know, I'm sad to say, but, you know, even at cathedral parishes and stuff like that, people are just yakking it up all the time.
Right. Yeah. And you know, all good points. And, you know, I don't want to sound like I'm being harsh here, because I think there's been a couple of generations out of which this has emerged. And I think sometimes there is this good intention, you know, like to create community. And I think that's been sort of the narrative behind much of this, that we're trying to be welcoming and to engage people. But I think when you look at the culture as a whole and how things have shifted, our capacity for sustained attention has diminished. Like if you look at one of Newman's homilies, they're incredibly long. Or if you look at some of the fathers of the church and their sermons, they are very long. And the capacity of people to sit and listen to these lengthy and very developed homilies or sermons, it was for Newman, especially prior to his conversion to Catholicism, were incredibly beautiful. But the level of attention that a person would have had to have to follow him along through that would have been great. And now, you know, very early on as a priest, I realized you have about two to five minutes to, unless you're an exceptional preacher, to get in there and like give a little uppercut to sort of wake people up and then make your point and see it as a movement towards the celebration of the Eucharist. But the time period that you have to maintain the attention of your listeners is very limited. And so brevity and clarity become essential And not every priest should be a storyteller, you know, in fact, very few, because very few priests can tell stories well, and very few priests should, even fewer priests should tell jokes. I think I've told one joke during my time as a priest, and the whole congregation laughed because I was laughing at myself telling a joke, and it was so unusual that, you know, they were more shocked by it than the joke being funny. And so, you know, I think what begins to take place is that we gravitate to taking hold of things, to try to find ways to grab hold of people's attention, when it's really fostering this deep silence that allows this capacity to see through things with a kind of clarity. When the mind and the heart are stilled, then you can listen on a deeper level and be attentive. And this will come up as we go through these paragraphs. You begin to see the specific fruits of this way of life begin to unfold. And this is, I think, in our own spiritual lives, as we read through this, is what gradually we want to begin to recapture, that we foster in our lives a love for solitude. We begin to simplify our lives in such a way that it opens up the space for it. And then we go through that period of time where we struggle with what goes on internally, you know, our ability to sustain that silence and remain in the solitude as long as God desires us to do so, in order that it might be able to bear great fruit for us spiritually, that we might be able to move to this, you know, praying without ceasing. Ultimately, this is the goal for us. But if we're so scattered all the time and we have no silence, it's never going to emerge. Wayne.
Yeah, in our church, St. Basil's Ukrainian Church in Edmonton here, we're kind of lucky because as soon as the royal doors close, people drop to their knees. That's a beautiful, the cultures we need to develop in our church in that regard. Like I say, the final hymn, the royal door is closed, and people will kneel, will do, you know, prayer and thanksgiving for about 5 minutes, and then people will leave.
Right.
You know, then we'll get up and go, huh? Mm-hmm. Now, part of the issue, I'm just thinking in the Latin churches, when the priest comes in from the back, doesn't he? And then he goes to the altar, mm-hmm. and then when he leaves, he goes back.
Mm-hmm.
And I think in some of the churches, they follow him right after.
Mm-hmm.
And maybe that's where the problem is in terms of people not giving the opportunity for Thanksgiving after Mass. Yes, or no, I don't know.
Yeah, I did notice that within, you know, my experience of the Byzantine liturgy, that there wasn't that movement with procession like that. Mm-hmm. And it does foster this sense of, yeah. you know, go get out of here, you yeah. know, follow me out the door kind of thing. And it's a curious thing, though, within the Western church, you know, silence is built into the liturgy itself. And we have all these places where it's kind of built in, whereas in the Eastern Rite liturgy, you find a more kind of a constancy within the chant, mm-hmm. and which is beautiful in its own right. You know, this kind of almost imitation of the angels in this constant praise and worship of God. But within the Latin Rite, you have this built-in silence that is meant to help you focus on what's going on at the altar. And often that's cast aside very quickly. And we fill up that silence, mm-hmm. you know, with, you know, added hymns or a second homily is thrown in there sometimes by the priest, or announcements, or all different kinds of things. And so I don't want to spend too much time on this. I really want to get to what the fathers are saying here. But I think it's worth our, you know, thinking about on occasion. How do we, you know, what is this hypothesis calling us to? And how do we foster it? And what's the fruit, the precious fruit for us in it? An ascetic elder said, if a monk knows that there is a place where he can thrive spiritually, but does not go there because he might thus be deprived of the necessities of life, then this monk does not believe that God exists. So it's a pretty fierce and direct statement. He doesn't varnish the truth here at all, that, you know, a monk who goes into the desert or one who's seeking to thrive spiritually, but isn't willing to do what is necessary in order to be a monk, which means, you know, to be, you know, alone with God. If you aren't willing to make those sacrifices, then there is a lack of faith there. You know, if you're not willing to do everything that is necessary in order to foster the fruit of this particular vocation, then you're not engaging in it with full faith. And you have to ask yourself, well, why is it that you've chosen this path to begin with? And so it does not believe in God, that God exists. If one believed that God exists, one would understand that even in the deepest silence, God permeates that silence. The silence is pregnant with God himself. And one is not in isolation, but one experiences a kind of fullness in that silence. And this is why so many of the fathers say that silence is the language of God. And so the more we desire to listen to God, to hear his word, the more that we would seek silence in our lives and hold it to be precious. And more often than not, we fear it because we think that we are going to be left wanting, or we're going to be left deprived in such a way that it's going to do us harm, rather than that holding out something to us that is of great value, that being the pearl of great price. And if you think about that, this is why monks would like sell everything and go to purchase, if you will, the deep silence and the solitude of the desert, because they believe there a great treasure is to be found, the silence in which they can be immersed and wherein they encounter God as he is himself, that there's no impediment that they put up because they've set aside everything that they might be attached to, and even the most intimate relationships with others in order to attain it. And so this is why this elder could speak so kind of sternly. You know, this monk who does not hold this precious actually lacks faith. He doesn't believe in God. He doesn't believe God fills that silence and that solitude. And for us, you know, I think that it should speak to us as strongly that if we do not foster solitude in our life and we don't seek the silence that it offers, then there is a kind of lack of faith within us. If we cannot endure it, and if we don't simplify our lives to open up the space for it, there is a kind of lack of faith. You know, in a way, we're idolizing the self and this kind of satisfaction that we are seeking of being fulfilled by the things around us and others around us, that, you know, through our encounters with others or through the things that we have in our possession, what we're reading, what we're thinking about, what we're listening to, that we're holding those things up as that which fill us. Whereas the monks are telling us what fills us the most and what is most beautiful and what is to be sought above all things is God, and that he's found in that solitude. And again, you know, to think in this way is going to make us, you know, cultivate that solitude by, again, shaping our lives in a different fashion, that we're going to make certain choices over time where we realize that we are even going to have to say no to certain things that may seem benign to us, or even certain forms of entertainment or recreation that we have gravitated towards in the past. But we say no to that in order not simply, again, to deprive ourselves, but actually in our pursuit of that which is greater, that we're seeking a solitude and silence in order that we might be filled. And, you know, living as Christian men and women, you know, it's, our understanding of this should be great, that when we pour ourselves out and we fulfill that call to empty ourselves out in love for others as Christ does for us, and as we receive that kind of self-emptying love at the altar, then when we pour ourselves out, our desire should be to return to him in order that we might be filled, having emptied ourselves that we might be filled with his love and his grace. And it should almost become a natural thing for us to gravitate, as Philip Neri said, back to the nido, back to the solitude, in order that we might once again be restored in our strength to give ourselves to others once more. And I think this has become feared. I think there's a profound resistance to it in our generation, because we know this poverty that sort of Mother Teresa talked about, you know, this where we have so much and we've come to cling to it so much in terms of it shaping our identity, that the moment that we begin to set those things aside, we become very uneasy. And we become incapable of remaining in that silence, and so incapable of entering into this kind of intimacy with God. And I think even by extension, we become incapable of engaging each other in a kind of intimacy. This is where I get back to Henry Nouwen, writes a great deal about this. And I mentioned between husband and wife too, you know, this most deep and intimate of all relationships, that there is this kind of solitude that is required in order that one might step forward with one's truest self toward the other, that our capacity to see the other and to contemplate the other arises out of this solitude where we've come to see and understand ourselves and our truest identity too. So if we're living in this constant frenetic pace and our minds are filled with all these things constantly, then we are not actually going to be able to see the other, even in these closest of relationships, that they become one thing, if you will, among others, rather than the most important person within our life. And it's really only solitude and the depth of prayer that allows us to see that. And outside of it, I think then eventually the individuals, the moment they begin to cease satisfying a certain desire on for us, you know, where they become more of a liability to us because they're an irritation, then relationships begin to fall apart because we no longer see the individual, the person. We see them as an obstacle to love, an obstacle to intimacy, because in some sense we falsely made them at one point, perhaps, our God, or we've looked for a kind of fulfillment in them outside of that relationship with God. So we've placed upon them this unbearable burden to be God. And then when they fail to be God, we despise them for it. And this can exist within any kind of relationship too, in religious communities. You know, we come in, you know, thinking, oh, you know, I'm going to be a part of this community and it's going to be fulfilling and we're going to live this good and holy life together, you know, praying all these times. And, you know, after a while, you know, you can come to despise people and see everything that's irritating about them, everything that's deficient about them. And then you gravitate not to solitude, but you gravitate to being alone simply because you can't stand being around people. That's different than solitude. I feel so convicted. Sometimes I, you know, my own words are piercing to myself. I can't stand myself. Okay. You see where I'm going, though, and where they're going. So let's move on. Number four, a brother asks one of the elders, "Why, Father, is it not possible for those of our generation to maintain the ascetic life of the fathers before us?" "Because," the elder answered, "it neither loves God, nor does it flee away from people, nor does it disdain the material goods of this world. For in the soul of a man who flees from other men and from materialism, there begins to be born a spontaneous contrition and desire for the ascetic life. Just as someone who wants to extinguish a fire in his field, but has no time to cut away those things which lie before the spreading fire, will thus be unable to put it out. So a man, if he does not flee to a place where he earns his bread only with great labor, cannot succeed in the ascetic life. For the soul does not quickly want that which it cannot see. So, you know, solitude holds out that which is precious, this precious fruit that we cannot immediately see. And it's only by cultivating it over time, then we begin to see a couple of things emerge here. A spontaneous contrition, humility emerges because we begin to see the greater truth about what is within our heart. And so spontaneously, you know, tears begin to emerge, sorrow, contrition for one's sin. And also, he says here, a desire for the ascetic life, a desire for all those things that give us a greater freedom to love, and to love God and to love others. And this is where I think what Mother Teresa was getting at, that our poverty spiritually is greater than the material poverty of so many within the world, because we have all of these goods that we become attached to because we can see them. They're very tangible. They're held out to us in this way that they're very seductive, that if you have this, you will be fulfilled. But having engaged in this solitude and having set aside this attachment to material goods, what begins to emerge is this greater desire for that which has value, the desire for that which can fill that longing, that urgent longing within the human heart. And that is the love of God alone. And so a person who's entered into this life and remains in it, even though he cannot see the fruit of it immediately, who's embracing sort of the wisdom of those who've gone before him, once he begins to taste it, begins to experience all the more this kind of urgent longing and desire for God, the fruit of that ascetic life. And so it no longer simply becomes a discipline of setting aside things, of depriving oneself of things, but it becomes the very vehicle to seeking out the heavenly bridegroom, seeking out unimpeded, running as quickly as we can to the one alone who can fulfill the deepest desires of the human heart. This is why Christ sends out, you know, his disciples almost empty-handed. You know, it's that they might run swiftly, you know, with nothing holding them down. They aren't running with a heavy tread, but now they're running with the swiftness of one called, as it were, by the beloved. And an interesting image that comes to the Gospels is the resurrection. You know, Peter had betrayed the Lord, denied him. And so they're told, you know, the Lord has been raised. And they run to the tomb, Peter and the beloved disciple. And Peter is outrun. And the beloved disciple runs with a kind of swiftness of, you know, a friend called, one who is love called. He runs and he gets to the tomb first, whereas Peter is running with this kind of heavy tread, weighed down by the burden of his own betrayal yet. And I think in the spiritual life, we often, you know, we run with that heavy tread because we're burdened so often by the weight of our own sin, but also by the weight of the things that we load upon our own shoulders that we tell ourselves are necessary for our identity, our fulfillment. And so it's like we're carrying around a knapsack of bricks, and we wonder why, you know, life is such a drudgery, and, you know, we feel so weighed down by it. And this is, I think, part of the reason what they're laying out here for us. The soul does not quickly want that which it cannot see. And so the more one begins to see it, one wants it more. And so that desire grows. We begin to see what the source of our incompleteness is, where that lack comes from. And it comes from the lack of intimacy with God. I saw a hand up here. There was somebody, or was that somebody who had their hand mistakenly up? Okay. All right. So a brother asked Abba Sissos, "Father, what does it mean to remove oneself to a remote place? To be silent," the elder replied, "and to have nothing of your own. Whether or not you seek a remote place, this is a true retreat to remoteness." So to be silent, and here we get back to what we had been talking about. You know, this is where we move to that remote place. So it's not necessarily our going off to the deserts of Egypt. It can simply be a willingness to enter into the desert, as it were, of our own hearts and to remain there and to seek to stay there until a kind of stillness begins to emerge and to have nothing of your own. And so we don't cling to anything in this world as if it were anything except that it came to us from the hands of God, that all is gift. And so we realize that what is ever we lose or is taken from us, we lose nothing, because all things come to us from the hand of the great giver, from God. And in a sense, we are to foster, I think, this what Job articulates so well, you know, the Lord giveth, the Lord taketh away, blessed be the name of the Lord. That there is this sense that the greatness of God and the abundance of his love, when that is seen, it provides us with a kind of freedom. You know, when we find ourselves either experiencing blessing or want, we don't become overly attached to the things that we have in those times of blessing, and we don't overly mourn the loss of them, because we know in God we have all, we have everything. And so ultimately, there should be a kind of freedom that emerges for us. Daniel Allen, was that you with your hand up early, or did you change your mind?
I changed my mind. It's okay.
You sure?
Yeah.
Okay. All right. Okay. Number six. So I think we're getting a better sense of where they're leading us. A brother asked an elder, "Father, what is the virtue of withdrawing to a remote place?" The elder in response related the following. "I know a brother who lives as a hermit. He was once in church and, as is customary, afterwards got in line for dinner and thus sat down to eat with the brothers in the trapeza, that is the refectory. When several of the brothers saw him, they said, 'Who asked him to stay to eat?' And addressing him, they said, 'Get up and leave here.' Immediately, the stranger got up from his place and went out of the refectory. Several other brothers, however, were sorry for the rudeness toward the stranger and called him to the refectory again. When he sat down at the table, they asked him, 'Tell us what feelings you had when you were so rudely thrown out of the refectory and then led back.' The stranger answered quietly, 'At that moment, I thought of myself as one of the dogs who leave when they are thrown out and who come when they are called.'" So a kind of interesting thing, you know, that he could, in his humility, be able to receive either one of those things without having his identity disturbed or the stillness within his heart disturbed. He could be like a dog that is thrown out, "Get out of here, you know, you noisemaker," or called in to receive food, to receive from the hand of his master. But in both cases, not being undone. And it's reminiscent of the story of the woman in the gospel, you know, who is seeking you know, mercy from the Lord. And he says, you know, you don't give to the bread of the children to the dogs. Yes, Lord, but even the dogs get the scraps that the children throw beneath the table. That he saw in her this capacity for this humble faith, that she was willing to receive whatever scraps, knowing that the scraps from the Lord's table were the greatest of all blessings, and that and so she would not be dissuaded. And in this man, we see something similar, a kind of quiet humility that develops out of, I think, of this remoteness that is being spoken of here in this hypothesis, that has gradually let go of everything of the world, where you begin to see where your real worth, identity, integrity come from, and you rely more and more upon the providence of God. And the more, it's sort of curious, you know, the more that we have and the more that we cling to what we have, we begin to lose that trust in God and his providence. And we feel that we need more and more, to provide us with this kind of insurance against the unexpected things of this world. We become like the individual in the gospel who wants to tear down his barns and build greater ones to hold all of his grain, and not realizing that he's going to die that very night. You know, that we take hold of these things that offer a false security rather than taking hold of the grace and the love of God. And what the Desert Fathers, I think, highlight for us is this radical renunciation and the freedom that came through that radical renunciation of the things of this world, that they could let go of them and to live wholly in their pursuit of God, trusting that he would provide what is needed for them. And it's often for us difficult for us to get through a given day without the anxieties of life and the world pressing down upon us so heavily that we feel undone. And I think that's why we escape into so many of the forms of entertainment that we have, to alleviate the mind from those anxieties that we have, because we've never perhaps tasted something here that the remoteness gives rise to. We never have that desire begin to grow within us that leads us to want to embrace the ascetic life that draws us to God, who alone can satisfy the deepest longings of the heart. And so we keep going back over and over again. You know, we repeat the same pattern in our life hundreds of times, thinking that we are going to be able to find that sense of security or that sense of fulfillment within something. And that can be true even in certain religious aspects of our life and our identity. We can cling to these things in an abstracted way, abstracted, that is, from our relationship with God and his love. So we can seek a kind of security in our external religious behaviors, but really not having a mind and a heart connected to God in love. And so in this sense, we can fall back into a kind of Pharisaism, you know, that we are placing a great deal of trust simply in our external religious actions and behavior. As if, you know, we're storing up these, you know, good behaviors, you know, for the future, rather than seeing, you know, God's mercy coming to us from the hand of God, you know, and out of his generosity, not as earned. Okay, hands are going up and down. People are changing their mind tonight a lot. Daniel, go ahead.
Just one thought that I guess came to mind while you were saying that is, it's kind of like love doesn't seek assurances, you know, it just simply trusts, but it's very difficult. You know, I think that that's a difficult thing. I think that's that circling back to, as you said, almost like consistently, you know, repeating patterns, seeking out assurances or what is the word you said? Something about like abstracting things, all of that. But at the end, like, you know, those things, it's just it's a running pattern, because it's seeking after something that's less than that which is being sought after.
Right. And it can be exhausting, because I think
yeah.
the more that we have those things, the more desperate we become to protect them. Especially if we hold on to the illusion that they are what provide us our identity. And so long as we hold on to that illusion, then we're going to desperately be trying to protect them and protect ourselves from others and protect us from anything that could come in and take these things from us. And Teresa of Lisieux said something similar. Love does not calculate. You know, that the more that she became immersed in that divine love, the more that she began to see that love expends itself, pours itself out completely without counting the cost, you know, and wondering, I think most of us have this sense that if we give ourselves in the way that we see Christ give himself, we are going to find ourselves wanting, impoverished beyond measure, and rather than experiencing a kind of freedom and depth of love and the power of his grace active in our life. What we really fear is that we are going to find ourselves in a position where we're in a world of hurt because we've let go of what we held on to, that we made a mistake in believing and trusting. And, you know, I don't want to sound flippant about this because I know it's hard. You know, it's very difficult to let go of our hold upon those things that perhaps we've spent decades building up, you know, the sense of identity, a personality we've all built, you know, in some way. And to allow that to be reshaped by God's grace and to put on the mind of Christ and to allow his word, you know, to shape and reform, us from within in our very identity can be an unsettling thing. It's a fearful thing to fall into the hands of the living God, to allow him to remake us by his grace. And, often we will return to that which is more familiar, just because it's more comfortable, not because it's more fulfilling or gives hope. Okay. I have 7:32, and so we could stop there, but anybody have any final thoughts? It's a lot to think about and a lot to pray about. Rachel, I thought I saw your hand earlier.
Hi. So I kept raising my hand, but then you would answer.
Okay.
My concerns and my questions, but I just wanted to add that, you know, what you were saying about, our ideas of God and this abstract idea. And I think you touched upon our tendencies to set up idols, mm-hmm. you know, our ideas of how we should be, of how God or who God is.
Right.
Slowly but surely, and perhaps you can also address this, is it seems to me that living or our Lord communicating his life to us, it's never ever going to be static. It's not just going to stay still. It's always going to be moving and changing and growing, hopefully. Right. And that, you know, we...
Oops, you cut off your mic. You cut off your microphone. maybe she can't get back on, but I think I get the gist of what she was saying there. And, you know, allowing this kind of allowing God to shape us is a kind of ecstatic reality. She's right on the money there. That I think.
Is that what you're saying?
What's that?
Is that what you're saying? I'm sorry, I'm driving. I had a late meeting today, and so I had to join you from the car.
That's fine. And that's, I'm sort of reiterating, I think, what you were articulating, that there is this kind of ecstatic nature to that relationship with God. You know, we aren't passive recipients of something. We're entering into this relationship, but a relationship that is really calling us out of ourselves, this limited view of who we are as human beings and who God is. And so it is ecstatic. You know, it is drawing us out of this image, this limited image and idea of who we are and what love is, and letting go of that limited image, that limited idol that we've created in our minds and our hearts, is a very difficult thing to do, because we let go. And to do that means letting go of the crutches and the things that we hold on to that perhaps have provided us with a certain element of stability or even helped us move along in the path of faith. But when God draws us to this greater intimacy with him, and draws us more and more deeply into his love, it means letting go of the things that are not God in order that we might experience him as he is in himself. And, you know, our vision of that is always going to be much less than what it is. And so letting go of even our understanding of God and of love, and allowing ourselves, like Peter, when Peter says, "Lord, where are we to go? You have the words of everlasting life." He's being drawn into this deep mystery of the Holy Eucharist, that Christ is going to give himself to us as our very food and drink, nourish us to everlasting life upon himself. And Peter can only say, you know, where are we to go? He can acknowledge that his words are life, but he has to let go of this limited understanding of God and his own experience of reality itself, his own experience and understanding of love, in order to be drawn into this deeper reality, to allow God to reveal himself more fully. Sometimes we want God to stay behind the veil. It's much less frightening. Or maybe we like the frightening thing more, feel more comfortable with it. Maybe sometimes that feels secure. It's like the Wizard of Oz, you know, so long as he was that big green head, you remember that? And the scene, you know, where the guys behind the screen, you know, there's a kind of security in that. He seems the great and powerful Oz, you know, is, you know, they could be living this illusion, but that illusion made them feel safe. And I think sometimes in the spiritual life, we can do the same thing. We can cling to this illusion of this great and powerful God protector, but it's this great, powerful God protector that we fashion in our own eyes, that we've projected, you know, often out of our own experience, limited experiences, sometimes traumatic experiences, diminished experiences of what love is. And we project those things out onto God. And so to let God reveal himself to us in this way, especially in the way that Christ does, you know, this radical vulnerability, you know, that he allows himself to be arrested, you know, that he's beaten, pinned to the cross, but also giving himself to us as Eucharist, you know, this small host, you know, that there is this kind of radical vulnerability there with which he gives himself to us. You know, that can be a hard thing, because that means, you know, this is what love is. It's vulnerable, and it gives itself without counting the cost. And it, you know, it conquers not with power and force, but with gentleness, meekness. Okay. One final thought, and we'll wrap it up. George, you're new to the group, right, tonight?
Yes, this is my first one. Thank you for having me.
You're welcome.
Some of the things that were discussed here tonight, I'm reading through Dante's Divine Comedy, and it reminds me a lot of that, in that Dante first has to pass through hell, where he forgoes, he learns all about the passions that you need to drop, followed by purgatory, which is about wrong attachments. And then he reaches a point in purgatory where reason itself can't take him any further, but he needs to sort of be to love his way to the celestial heavens by the guiding hand of Beatrice.
Right. Absolutely. Perfect. And because I think this is exactly what the fathers are putting before us. You know, it's with a kind of stark simplicity and of their statements, and but every bit is profound in the living icons that they become for us, you know, of this reality, of what that looks like to become this vulnerable before God and to let go of those illusions and to allow oneself to be drawn on by love. I think the saints as a whole, and celebrating All Saints Day today, you know, this is what they show us most powerfully, you know, all in these, you know, unique ways, but nonetheless, they show us the same thing, what it is to be drawn along by love. Good. So thanks, George. Thank you for questioning. And again, welcome. So always good to have new people here. So we'll close there. It's almost 8:45. And when we close, as always, with the Our Father. In the name of the Father, and of the Son, and of the Holy Spirit. Amen. Our Father, who art in heaven, hallowed be thy name. Thy kingdom come, thy will be done, on earth as it is in heaven. Give us this day our daily bread, and forgive us our trespasses, as we forgive those who trespass against us. And lead us not into temptation, but deliver us from evil. Amen. The Lord be with you.
And with your spirit.
May Almighty God bless you, the Father, the Son, and the Holy Spirit. Amen. Go in peace.
Thanks be to God.
God bless you.